And then we'll come back and we'll get going.
Probably do his study. I just went to
Gary and the Texans.
Something I went to.
Roger and I were. When we were taking a break, Roger and I were talking for a few minutes about something that I think everybody could agree on, and that's the importance of trying to utilize the resources here to add value and provide jobs for our young people so we can keep young people employed with good, meaningful jobs. And the thing that I've talked about so many times and tried to promote so often was some good, non-polluting, value-added forest products industry jobs. Well, what we've seen in Vilas County, for example, is the county fathers, and it seems generation after generation, thinking that second home development's the only economy, the only answer to the economy, and now we found out different than that. You go over to Iron County, and they're trying to promote a mine when they don't even have an ore body that's proven. So it's time for people on the ground to start networking and say, come on, folks, there's a resource and it's renewable, and let's do something with it so we can add value here. The point is that Roger and I were talking about, you can harvest a truckload of high-value oak veneer logs, and it's going to be worth somewhere between $3,000 to $5,000 when it leaves the county. And if that same wood went into grandfather clocks, for example, what would it be worth? $3 million. So, and I'm not saying it's grandfather clocks are going to be the answer, but I'm using that as an example. I mean, we need to do something at the ground level to start promoting the adding of value to the resource before it leaves the area. We've got a crisis in the area right now. We can't provide sustainable jobs for our young people to keep them here. And yet we're letting the resource leave here at wholesale value. It doesn't make sense to me. So that's about all I wanted to say.
Start building the box, Joe.
We'll go on to Gary and let Gary get his any questions on Texas.
Okay. Yeah, first I want to say I'm well over 6 feet tall, and I feel a little bit like Mikey, my bowl of cereal here.
What'd you tell her, Chair?
I'm only 4'5".
Only 4'5". when Joe first called me about doing this, I was thinking, oh boy. Because, the tax code isn't necessarily set up to conserve land. Its goal is to raise revenue for the Treasury. And so it's such that, they're looking for for-profit activities, and they normally deny deductions to activities that are not for-profit. But that being said, Congress also made room for charitable activities, being what they determine in the public good, so to speak. So I thought, yeah, I'll take a look at that, Joe, and I'll see what I can do. Congress felt it would also serve the public good if allowed deduction from income for taxpayers who donated to, say, a 501c3 organization or a church or a governmental entity. And that kind of enters the land trusts that have been talked about today. I'm also involved with some land trust, a land trust organization, the Couderay Waters Regional Land Trust. They're a 501c3, as most of the land trusts are. And we work with landowners in a specific area in northwestern Wisconsin. I'd like to first talk about the tax opportunities of conservation easements, and a little bit about the rules of taking a tax deduction in regard to conservation easements. It's not a slam dunk. You have to dot your I's and cross your T's when you're working with this. Basically, a landowner can make a gift to a land trust of a conservation easement. And the conservation easement is an interest in real property, basically, that is being used or given to that qualified organization for conservation purposes. A way to think about that is a landowner has a bundle of rights. Now, I was going to bring some pens, so I'll just steal yours, man, if that's okay. A landowner has a certain bundle of rights. And in essence, what you're doing is you're giving one or more of those rights to that conservation organization. Okay, and that's what you're donating it. Or it could be a governmental entity as well that you're donating to. And because you're donating something of value to a 501c3 or a governmental entity, you're allowed then to take a deduction for the value of that conservation easement. Now, a couple rules. First of all, that donation must be legally binding. Okay, if it's not a legally binding donation, it's not going to qualify. It also must be permanent, which means forever. So, for instance, if you have a piece of property in North Dakota and you donate the development rights to a land conservation organization, you will not be able to take a charitable contribution deduction for that because North Dakota law limits them to 99 years. That's not in perpetuity. It's not permanent. Okay? And the current and future owners are bound by the terms of this conservation easement. Okay, so it's not something that changes once you pass away. It stays forever. The donation must also be a right that you possess. You cannot take a donation for a right that you didn't possess. An example of that would be, let's say you own property that's in a floodplain. If you went down to zoning, and wouldn't be able to get a building permit for that, you're not going to be able to take a donation for donating development rights, okay? Because you're not allowed to develop it, okay? Anyway, so there's no change in the value of the property for you. There's four deductible types of conservation easements. One is a preservation of land areas for outdoor recreation by or the education of the general public, protection of relatively natural habitat of fish, wildlife, plants, or similar ecosystems, preservation of open space, including farmland and forest land, and preservation of a historically important land area or certified historic structure. So those are the four types. Now, what is the value of a conservation easement? That has to be determined by a qualified appraisal. And the value is the fair market value at the time of the contribution. And so to the extent there is a substantial record of sales of easements that are comparable to yours, then that fair market value will be based on those sale prices. If there is no substantial record of marketplace sales, then the fair market value is going to be determined by the difference between the fair market value before the easement and the fair market value after the easement. The IRS is paying a lot more attention to these appraisals these days associated with conservation easements, as there have been some pretty questionable easements or valuations that have been brought to light by major media. And so people have gotten pretty pissed off about that. So the IRS is looking at these pretty closely. With a charitable contribution, this gets a little bit confusing because typically, in order to take a charitable contribution on your tax return, you have to donate a complete interest in property. So as an example, if I own a timeshare in Florida, and I let my church group use that timeshare for a week, I don't get any deduction for that because I didn't donate a complete interest. Okay? Or if I own an office building and I let a charitable organization use the third floor, I don't get a deduction for that because, again, it's not the donation of a complete interest. But conservation easements are a rare exception to that rule. That's one thing about taxes. You know, you have the rule, and then you have the exceptions. And then you have the exceptions to the exceptions. Okay? That's the way it always seems to work. Number two, there must be charitable intent. Okay, the receipt or expectation of something of value coming back to you then will reduce or eliminate the charitable contribution deduction. The burden is on the taxpayer, on you, to demonstrate that the property transferred is a deductible contribution. So you need to have a contemporaneous written acknowledgement from the donee organization that you donated something. If the donation's large enough, the donee also needs to sign off on a form that has to go with your tax return. And if the donation's in excess of $5,000 in value, you need to have a qualified appraisal, and the appraiser also has to sign off on a form that goes with your tax return. And the IRS has strict rules on who qualifies as a qualified appraiser. And they actually have disbarred some appraisers from doing these appraisals because of the shoddy work that they've done on those. So you have to make sure that if you're donating a conservation easement and you're getting an appraisal done, that it's being done by a qualified appraiser. So how much can you deduct then on your tax return? Well, through December 31 of last year, there was a 50% of adjusted gross income limitation. What that means is, let's say that you have, you earn $100,000 a year, and that's your adjusted gross income. You could deduct up to half of that, $50,000, as a charitable contribution each year. Okay, and then there was a 15-year carryover. So if you had donated, say, something that was valued at $60,000, you'd take $50,000 that first year, and then the next year you'd take the remaining 10. If you were a farmer or a rancher, you could deduct up to 100% of AGI, that $100,000, again with a 15-year carryover. Now that all changed as of December 31 of last year. So beginning January 1 of 14, it's back to the old rules, which was 30% of adjusted gross income with a 5-year carryover. So again, that example, you've got $100,000 of income, your adjusted gross income is $100,000. 30% of that would be $30,000. If you donated $60,000 to a charity, you could take $30,000 that first year. You could take the other $30,000 the second year. If you don't use up the entire charitable contribution in the 5-year carryover period, you lose what's left. Okay, it's gone. There's also the possibility or option to do a bargain sale. Okay, and a bargain sale is where you're in essence selling that easement to the organization for less than fair market value. And then what we're going to do then is allocate your basis between what was sold and what was donated. Let's see, okay, so the bargain sale, okay, is going to be treated partly as a charitable contribution and partly as a sale or exchange. And the fair market value of the contributed part is going to be the total fair market value of the easement less what you received on the sale. So I do have an example here. Betty sells a conservation easement to a qualified organization for $10,000. Okay, the fair market value of the easement is $12,500. Okay, so the fair market value before the conservation easement is $30,000, and she's got a basis of $12,000 in the property. So she does have a contribution. She sold the property for $10,000. Its fair market value is $12,500. So she has a $2,500 charitable contribution. So that would be her donation deduction. Then we have to allocate that $12,000 of basis because we're not going to be able to use all of her basis against that $10,000 of proceeds. So in essence, we're going to take a look at the fair market value of the timberland after the conservation easement, which is the $30,000 total less the $12,500 that was allocated to the conservation easement, and in essence, allocate based on those relative fair market values. So in this case, we're going to allocate $5,000 of her $12,000 basis to the conservation easement. Okay, that's just pure math there. And then we have to allocate between what was sold and what was donated, okay, and that $5,000. And so the sales price, in essence, was the $10,000. The fair market value was $12,500. And so we multiply that times the $5,000 basis. So we got $4,000 that would be allocated to the sale price. The other $1,000 basis is going to be lost. Okay, that's going to disappear. Now the reason for that is because they're getting a much better deal. They're getting to deduct the fair market value, which is the $2,500. Okay, so they're getting the $2,500 deduction rather than the $1,000 deduction. And so that $1,000 just disappears. That's one nice thing on charitable contributions. You know, if you're contributing property that's appreciated in value, you get to deduct the fair market value of that property on the date that you donated it. Okay, so that's a nice nice tax incentive. If she would have had a sale on that, a loss on the sale of that conservation easement, she wouldn't be able to claim a loss. Any excess basis then would stay with the basis of the attributes that she retained. Okay. Let's see. So I have another example where I won't go through that. Are there any questions on conservation easements?
Is the federal Congress, they're in the process of maybe changing it back to last year's thing, and they still might in the lame duck do something, and then
there's a whole mess of extenders that expired at the end of December of last year that you know, we don't know currently what their status is. You know, there was a bill that the House passed, but it's a long way from done.
Right, because we have a couple of easements that are being held up,
okay,
waiting
for that. Okay.
See if
sure. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Yeah, and they could, like they did a couple of years ago, they could wait until the next year to pass them retroactively.
Yeah, that's what we're hoping.
You're hoping, I'm not. The reason being is it screws everything up. You know, it delays the filing season. The software all has to be changed. And then you're trying to learn new tax law as you're entering the tax season, and that gets just to be a terrible nightmare. And I wish Congress would quit doing that. So anyway, I'd like to shift to like-kind exchanges, and you'll see why in a minute once I get through them. You know, I was thinking, you know, perhaps you own an investment or business property in Wisconsin, and you know, after the last couple of winters here, you want to take off and do something in Arizona instead, and you'd like to take your tree farm with you. You know, you can do that, and you can do it tax-free. It's called like-kind exchange. You know, it has to be, you know, business or investment property. You know, a tree farm could be either one of those. And you can exchange it for property in Arizona and then move down there and manage your tree farm down in Arizona. So you can take it with you, right? And there's no tax on the exchange. In essence, what it is it's a tax deferral. Any gain that you have on the property that you're giving up is then basically transferred into the property that you're receiving. And so if you'd ever sell that property sometime down the line, you'd recognize the gain at that point in time. Okay. And the like-kind exchange rules for real property are really quite liberal. Some in Congress would like to change that, by the way, too, because it's a little bit too liberal in some people's opinion. In essence, real estate for real estate is the rule, okay? Or personal property for personal property. You can't exchange personal property, a truck, for instance, for real estate. Okay, that wouldn't qualify. But real estate for real estate could be an office building in downtown wherever for a parcel of forest land. Okay, that would qualify as like-kind exchange. Okay, so it's very, very liberal. If you don't receive any boot in the exchange, and boot is cash, then there will be no gain that's recognized. If you have to pay boot, then that's going to be added to the basis in the property you received. And as I inferred earlier, your basis in the property received is going to be a carryover basis from the property you relinquished. So you'd have that basis plus any boot that you paid. Now I did draw a couple diagrams. I don't know if you can, probably can't see them from this from that distance, but there's a simple like-kind exchange is you know, I own a piece of property that you want, you own a piece of property that I want, and so we shake hands and you take my property and I take your property. Okay, that's a very simple like kind of exchange. I don't think that ever happens. generally, you know, I don't have the property that you want, you know, so, but somebody else has got the property that you want, but they don't want to exchange. They want cash, right? And so you have to try to figure out, well, how do we do a like kind of exchange in that circumstance? Well, you have to get what we call a qualified intermediary. That's the QI. And in essence, in this example, you're giving your land to the qualified intermediary that you want to exchange. And then you need to identify property that you want to acquire. And then that qualified intermediary will take that land and they'll sell it for cash, okay? And then they'll take the cash that they sell it for and buy the land that you're looking for. And then they'll turn around and give you the land back, okay? So in essence, what you did was exchange land for land, right? So you're meeting the criteria. And you say, well, that seems like a heck of a lot of work just to do an exchange. What if we just, you know, make the deal between the three of us? Well, it isn't going to work, because as soon as that dollar touches your hand, it no longer qualifies for a like kind of exchange. Okay? And so now you're recognizing gain. So that's the role of a qualified intermediary there.
Who are they?
Is there one around here, Joe?
We just completed one because we sold part of the Pilgrim River holding to the Keweenaw Land Trust and the Houghton Conservation District as a community forest. They were successful in getting a community forest grant. And I even got a notification on Thursday that the Forest Service was using our community forest deal in the UP as their headline in the budget process to continue the community forest program. And it was kind of gratifying time when at the dedication, because Neil Bumgard from the Forest Service told me personally, he said, thank you for transferring such a beautiful, well-stocked parcel of forest land. Most of the stuff I see is cut over timberland. So it's sort of a gratifying time. But anyway, to shorten the story and answer Gary's question, we just used a qualified intermediary that was located in southern Michigan, and it was totally painless. It was absolutely painless. She was real sharp. She was very, very thorough. And according to what I've learned recently, they have stricter guidelines to go by than they did just a few years ago, and It was, at least in this case, she was more thorough and probably more strict and a little more paperwork than the time we had done it 5 years ago. And she charged $500 to do it, but it was absolutely painless. There was just absolutely no problem at all.
Is that a title company usually?
It used to be more often title companies,
but they
seldom do it anymore because... Is it the underwriters that are afraid of them or something like that? Maybe the guidelines weren't strict enough for them or whatever, but now they're generally strict 1031 companies.
Okay.
So then there's more strict guidelines. You can't flip it like they used to, and then if you sell, you give it to your, if you do a 1031, you have to wait 2 years before you...
Yeah, I'm going to be talking about that, the related parties. Yeah.
What happens if a guy buys a piece of land and he's flipping, he sold it, buyer wants to close now, and now the owner doesn't want to close till 15 because of tax purposes. He could get a qualified intermediary to close the deal in December, and then he's going to finish his 1031 in 15. That would be legal then, wouldn't it?
Well, there's different times here. Like, for instance, you know, we have identification and we have receipt dates here.
Yeah.
So, like, for instance, the identification of the property must be identified within 45 days of the date the property was given up. Okay, so it could happen, you know, at the end of the year, you give up the property to the qualified intermediary. The qualified intermediary Sells it, holds the money.
And then this guy buys another piece in January or February.
Right, right.
Within the time frame.
Yep, yep, within the time frame, right. And then you have to receive property by the earlier of 180 days after the property was given up, or the due date of the tax return or extensions. And that's a tax trap in the making there, because if it happens late in the year that you give up the property, what's going to happen first is April 15th is going to come around, okay, before the 180 days is up. And if you file a tax return, then you've got to receive the property before April 15th, okay? So if you find yourself in that situation, you know it's going to be difficult to receive the property, then what you want to do is extend your tax return. And what that does then is it'll end up giving you the full 180 days. So that's just one of those little things you got to be watching out for. The related party exchanges, if you do an exchange with a related party and within 2 years either party to that exchange sells the property that they received, then gain is recognized. Okay, and the reason for that, obviously, is so that you can't shift the gain to your child who maybe is in a lower tax rate. Okay, so that's the reason they have that.
This is only between related parties.
Related parties. Which
and how are related parties defined?
As immediate family members, brothers, sisters, spouses, ancestors, and lineal descendants, and corporations, LLCs, partnerships, in which you have an interest of 50% or more.
So if you were a partner in an LLC with somebody, you could not relinquish your rights to them and be eligible for a 1031.
Well, you could still do the 1031, but if the partnership would sell that property, or the other party to that transaction would sell the property,
okay.
Then you would have an issue if you were a 50% owner in that partnership. Okay. Right. And so, again, the reason there is just so that you don't have the opportunity to shift income from a high tax bracket to a low tax bracket. That's the reason for that. So the reason I brought up the like-kind exchange was because then the next question that comes up, can we do a like-kind exchange of a conservation easement? Okay, so that's a good question. And the IRS has issued numerous letter rulings that yes, you can. Okay, now if you know anything about tax law, a letter ruling doesn't carry a heck of a lot of weight. It only pertains to the people who requested the letter ruling. It doesn't pertain to anybody else. So there has been nothing in tax court, no revenue rulings, nothing by Congress that indicates that yes, it qualifies as a like-kind exchange. But the IRS has given us an indication by the way it's ruled on these letter rulings that yes, it would qualify as a like-kind exchange. An example of that would be a landowner agreeing to give up development rights on his property in exchange for an adjoining property. Okay, so that would qualify. So would an exchange of a conservation easement for other property also subject to a conservation easement qualify? An example there would be Mary owns timberland A near a metropolitan area. The local land trust owns timberland B, which is next to Mary's property. Timberland B is subject to a conservation easement. The land trust would like to exchange timberland B in exchange for a conservation easement on timberland A. And again, the IRS has indicated in a letter ruling that would qualify as a like-kind exchange.
Even though they're not real like, because the one that's already got the development rights gone,
right,
and given up development rights are two different. They're not all alike,
but
they still qualify.
Yeah, well, same thing as with a like-kind exchange of a commercial building in downtown for a woodland.
Yeah, exactly.
They're not really exactly. Like, but they qualify exactly. Under the rules for like-kind exchange.
Exactly.
Yeah. Exactly. So, again, you got to be careful with some of this stuff because it's not codified at all. There's no.
In other words, it's not in the tax code.
It's not in the tax code, right?
But they've given these rulings.
So it's in our tax code. That's all important.
What's that?
It's in our tax code.
In our tax code?
The relevant tax code.
The relevant tax code, yeah. And then the last thing I wanted to touch base on were estate tax. I guess there's two things. Estate tax provisions. Because maybe your idea of conserving land has nothing to do with a conservation easement. You know, you'd like the property to stay in the family, but you don't want to lose it through the estate tax provisions. And really since 2012 or so, the estate tax provisions have really gotten quite generous. So if you die in 2014, estates up to $5,340,000 in value are tax-free. Okay, so that's over $5 million, okay, of an estate. And that's per individual, okay? So if you're married, you have $5,340,000, and your spouse has $5,340,000. And they also enacted portability of that estate exclusion. What that means is that you can elect to basically take the exclusion amount from the first spouse to pass away and that wasn't used and tack it on to the estate of the surviving spouse. Okay? So you can basically double the amount, you know, that you can die with without having to pay estate taxes.
Maybe that's why so many of our people are dying like that.
Yeah, maybe. So here's kind of an example. You know, Joe and Donna have assets totaling $7 million. And Donna dies and leaves all the assets to Joe. And that's real typical. And under the estate tax provisions, the way they've always been, transfers to the surviving spouse are not subject to estate tax. And they do not impact the exclusion amount. Okay, they don't go against that exclusion amount. So without electing portability, there's not going to be any estate tax for Donna because all the assets went to Joe. Okay, but when Joe passes away, he's only got the $5,340,000. His estate's worth $7 million. Okay, now he's got an estate tax liability, right? If they had elected portability on Donna's return, again, when she passed away, there'd have been no estate tax because all the assets went to the spouse. Then, and her exclusion amount of $5,340,000 would go to Joe, and so he has a $10,680,000 exclusion amount now, which totally covers that $7 million. Now, the interesting thing about this portability election is that it's not automatic. You have to elect it, which means that you have to file an estate tax return to do the election, okay? Which is a problem, you know, in my business, because you have a couple, you know, they have maybe 500,000 of assets, 600,000 of assets, maybe a million. One of the spouses passes away, well, do we elect portability? You know, they got $1 million of assets. That's well under the $5,340,000. So they don't really need it. But what happens if the story is, you know, that the spouse was so despondent they went to the casino, and lo and behold, won a huge jackpot, and you know, they hadn't elected portability. So then now the accountant's on the hook, right? Why didn't you elect portability, you know?
Is that done in a will, or is that done after the person's deceased?
That's done after they're deceased with the estate tax return. Yep. And so from my perspective in my business, I always recommend that we file an estate tax return to elect portability, because I don't want to be caught with that. But just so you know, that's available. If by chance your estate is more than that $5,340,000 or $10 million if you're married. I don't know if we have anybody in that boat here. But if it does exceed that, you can if it does exceed that, you can get started now. Because you can give $14,000 to any individual on a yearly basis, and that does not trigger a gift tax return. And it does not reduce your estate tax exclusion. And so if you have three kids, you can give them $14,000 each. And your wife can also give them $14,000 each. Okay? So you can get rid of some money that way. If you run out of kids That's okay too, because you can give this money to anybody, okay? Your tax preparer comes to mind. you know, so, and you, so you can give $14,000 to your tax preparer, your spouse can give $14,000 to your tax preparer, okay, on a yearly basis, all right? So you can get rid of, you can stand in front of Walmart and give out $100 bills if you want, you know, you can get rid of your estate if you want to do that. You can donate to charitable organizations, okay, subject to the parameters we talked about earlier. But that's why, you know, those of us in the tax profession have always referred to the estate tax as a voluntary tax. It's with the proper planning, there's nobody that needs to be paying an estate tax. You know, if they plan things right, give money away right, that kind of stuff, they can avoid the estate tax. Especially easy now with the limits the way they are.
And I might add, without interrupting Gary, there's a lot of literature here on transferring land to your next generation that's helpful to do just what Gary's referring to. There's a publication there from the Forest Service, and the same publication's on CD, I believe, sitting on top of the book. So.
Yeah, so that's basically what I had, Joe. I don't know if you have any questions.
And I'd say questions for anybody on the panel about any of the stuff that we've talked about.
Just one on like-kind exchanges. If I sell 40 acres of land for $100,000 and my cost basis, say, is $50,000 and I want to defer taxes, must I buy a comparable piece of real estate that exceeds $100,000, or could I buy something less and then defer proportionally?
Well, in essence, as long as you set it up as a like-kind exchange, okay, you could defer the gain. But now, what's going to happen in that situation is that, you know, if you're the property you're giving up is worth more than the property that you're receiving, you're going to get boot. Okay, and you're going to recognize gain to the extent of that boot received. So the potential gain on your property is $50,000 because you said its value was $100,000, its basis was $50,000. So let's say that you exchange that property for another piece of property and plus $40,000 of boot. You're going to recognize $40,000 of gain. Okay? So you're going to recognize a gain up to that $50,000.
So you'd pay some taxes immediately.
Yep. And then the other $10,000 gain is going to be deferred into the basis of that property you received.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. I have a question. Do I have to go over there to ask it?
No. Over to hell.
Well, all right. So I bought a property many years ago for $100,000. And then I sold an easement to the DNR for $30,000 cash this year. That's less than my basis. My basis is $100,000.
Right.
But I have $30,000 gain right now. It's not gain over in the top of the $100,000, but it is cash in my pocket.
That's correct.
What's the tax implications?
Well, in essence, you will be able to take some of that basis against the proceeds, and you would need to allocate those proceeds. Allocate the basis based on the fair market values of what was sold and what was retained.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Well, I would, on the face of it, it would look like the easement was 30% of the basis.
30% of the value?
Of the value of the basis. If
the easement that you gave up represented 30% of the total value of the property.
Yeah, that's a tough one because the property's probably changed in value over 30 years.
Right.
But I have to allocate some of that $30,000 to gain.
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, you're not going to be able to apply it all against basis, no.
Okay. So I have to proportion somehow. What I've done here in terms of basis.
Yep.
Okay.
Yep.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. There's a question over here.
Is the sense here just you, the property tax issues in Wisconsin have made a big mess, in my opinion? They vary over time?
No, that's Joe. But
what was that question?
But you know how I feel about the property taxes. You know, I did state that a little bit earlier, that you know, as far as how our property tax system came about and you know, where we're at with that and how that impacts forestry. And I think how that impacts people that may be thinking of investing in forestry. I think it...
Yeah, I get that piece. I guess I just was wondering what you meant in reference to conservation easements,
but that wasn't you. Right. Well, maybe Joe wants to add something in there.
So what was the question, Jerry?
It was in regard to your comment on the property taxes. The property tax issues in Wisconsin remain a big mess, in my opinion, and a very real deterrent to conservation. Even with MFLs and woodland
conservation owners. Easements, or did you just mean conservation in general?
I think conservation in general.
Okay.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think the question was more about conservation in general. Some of these were questions that people had asked me or that I remembered from mm-hmm. past discussions, you know. And the property tax issue is like I addressed earlier is being kind of brought to the light by this new organization that's forming now too, which is, it's not a nonprofit, it's a mm-hmm. it's a tax advocacy.
Yeah, it's a lobbying organization.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. So
mm-hmm. Well, I mean, from our perspective, what looks like a hindrance to holding our timberlands as we get older is the taxes.
Yeah, exactly.
And it seems like the conservation easements don't necessarily give you that much relief in property taxes.
Unfortunately, the tax assessors often do very little to recognize the conservation easement. That's why the MFL is still really critical, or some other property tax relief. Mm-hmm. I think what you're saying is very true. So I think so many tax assessors have blinders on when it comes to that. You know,
the MFL is just not something that we really are interested in, and so the conservation easement is something we are interested in.
Yeah.
But that is one of our goals, is to have the tax relief, and it doesn't really seem like that.
I think the first thing I would do is have a discussion with your tax assessor and say, what are you going to recognize this conservation easement as, because our land's going to be worth a lot less than it was before, mm-hmm. you know. So unfortunately, I think tax assessors seem to have a great amount of latitude, you know. Well, I mean, that's...
We drink with him, so that should be good for
yeah,
him.
Yeah, you should. Yeah.
Bring it up after he's drunk.
Yeah.
I had a couple of disputes with assessors over the last 4 years, and in both cases, they would not recognize my purchase price of property as legitimate for fair market value. But they would recognize the appraisals that I had subsequent by qualified appraisers. So I said, hey, I paid X dollars for this. And they said, we don't care, it's worth much more. And then I said, yeah, but this appraiser appraised it. And in both of those cases, I sent those appraisals, and that's what the assessment was. They changed it to that appraiser's. So I don't know. That's just my experience. I think in other cases, I've heard of land trust filing lawsuits over this issue, and how that came out, I don't know, but it's been a hotly disputed matter for a long time.